People had read the following excerpt from the CMRI website and asked how one would answer this. The article is entitled Episcopal Consecration During Interregnums by Bishop Mark A. Peveronis, CMRI. Quote, the following is an excerpt from Tu Nuovo Observatore Cattolico by Dr. Stefano Filiberto, who has a doctorate in ecclesiastical history. On November 29, 1268, Pope Clement IV died, and there began one of the longest periods of interregnum, or vacancy of the papal office in the history of the Catholic Church. The cardinals at that time were to assemble in conclave in the city of Viterbo, but through the intrigues of Carlo D'Angelo, King of Naples, discord was sown among the members of the Sacred College, and the prospect of any election grew more and more remote. After almost 3 years, the mayor of Viterbo enclosed the cardinals in a palace, allowing them only strict living rations until a decision would be made which would give the church its visible head. At last, on September 1, 1271, Pope Gregory X was elected to the chair of Peter. During this long period of vacancy of the apostolic see, vacancies also occurred in many dioceses throughout the world. In order that the priests and faithful might not be left without shepherds, bishops were elected and consecrated to fill the vacancies. There were accomplished during this time 21 known elections and consecrations in various countries. The most important aspect of this historical precedent is that all of these consecrations of bishops were ratified by Pope Gregory X, who consequently affirmed the lawfulness of such consecrations. Unquote that part of that author. Here are a few examples of the bishops thus consecrated at the time of vacancy of the Apostolic See. 1. In Avranches, France, Radufus de Thielville, consecrated November 1269. 2. In Alaria, Carissa, Nicolas Fortuguera, consecrated 1270. 3. In Antivari, Epiro, northwestern Greece, Caspar Adam Opi, consecrated 1270. 4. In Axeri, France, Herodas de Licinus, consecrated January 1271. 5. In Calgi, Italy, Jacobus, consecrated September 8, 1270. 6. In Le Mans, France, Gio Friedus de Asse, consecrated 1270. 7. In Cefalu, Sicily, Petrus Thars, consecrated 1269. 8. In Civia, Italy, Theodoricus Borgonori Opi, consecrated 1270. At this point, those who oppose the consecration of traditional Catholic bishops in our times might argue that the historical precedent cited was 700 years ago, and that Pope Pius XII, in view of the illicit consecrations of bishops in the Systematic National Church of China, decreed that any consecration of a bishop performed without papal mandate carried with it the penalty of ipso facto excommunication for the consecrator and for the consecrated. In order to answer this objection, it is necessary to understand the nature of law. It is precisely from the lack of clear knowledge of the principles of law that many traditional Catholics fall into error. St. Thomas Aquinas defines law as an ordinance of right reason made for the common good promulgated by one who has authority in that society. Let us note, made for the common good. In the time of Pope Pius XII, no bishop could lawfully consecrate another bishop without papal mandate, and this was for the common good of the Church. However, a law may, through the course of time and by radical change in circumstances, cease to be for the common good and, as such, cease to be binding. A law may cease in two ways: extrinsic succession, the legislature abrogates the law, and intrinsic succession, the law ceases to be a law as it has ceased to be for the common good. Unquote of the article by Mark Peveronis. I do not have the article Tu Nuovo Observatore Cattolico by Dr. Stefano Filiberto. Therefore, I do not know everything it contains. Maybe Pope Gregory X ratified these consecrations through some means of retroactivity. This method is used in marriage cases as explained in Canon 1138. I find that in the canon law books, Canons 1137 and 1138 explain how to make valid and invalid marriage by means of senatio in radice. Did you notice that nothing was made legitimate without a pope? The traditionalist movement members all assume that someday in the future there will be another pope that will justify the actions of their priests and bishops. Is their assumption prudent and logical? What does Pope Pius II say about the traditionalist movement appealing to a future council or a future pope that would justify what they are doing today? Let us read from the bull Exequabilis, written by Pope Pius II in 1459. Quote, "An abuse has grown in our age, whereby some men presume to appeal to a future council. Who would not regard as ridiculous in appealing to something that does not exist anywhere, and the future date of whose existence is unknown? We condemn such appeals, and if it should be detected that any such appeals are being put forward even now, then we censure them as being erroneous and detestable, destroyed and utterly annulled, and we decree and declare them to be inane and pestilential and of no importance." Unquote from Pope Pius II. Please answer question 171. Do you agree that Bishop Peveronis' article implies an appeal to some future pope or council to ratify today's traditionalist movement consecrations using Pope Gregory X's actions as justification for their disobedience to church laws? Bishop Peveronis presumes that the traditionalist movement's circumstances are the same as those in the 1200s. Even though all the undoubtedly legal justifications of Pope Gregory X are not fully known to us at the present time. As I said before, I have not read the full article. I will show below that the circumstances cannot be presumed to be the same in both cases. Please answer question 172. Do you agree that the Catholic Church, through Pope Pius II, has already condemned such an appeal? Canon 2332 reaffirms the bull of Pope Pius II and says that those who make such appeals to a future council contract an excommunication, which is especially reserved to the Holy See. Jesus Christ spoke to us through Pope St. Boniface II in Retro Marioribus Tuis, quote, "For it has never been allowed that that be discussed again, which has once been decided by the Apostolic See," unquote from Pope St. Boniface. Please answer question 173. Do you agree that the Apostolic See has already made the decision to condemn the appeal of the traditionalist movement to a future pope to justify their episcopal consecrations without a papal mandate? Please answer question 174. Do you agree that what Pope Gregory X did in the 1200s does not justify or make lawful the episcopal consecrations of the traditionalist movement bishops? How many years do the traditionalist movement bishops and priests believe they can function before a Catholic pope is elected? Who is going to elect the pope, say 50 or 100 years from now? Will it be the traditional movement bishops coming from who knows where and believing only God knows what? If these traditionalist movement bishops do not have unity among themselves at this time, then when will they? If they do not have unity in all the four marks of the Catholic Church, how can the non-Catholic bishops elect a Catholic pope? There are some major differences between the bishops mentioned above and the modern-day traditionalist movement bishops. Those priests in the 1200s did not first leave the Catholic Church and belong to a non-Catholic religion before they were consecrated. The bishops who consecrated the new bishops were all Catholics who had received jurisdiction from a Catholic pope. None of them had first left the Catholic Church and joined a non-Catholic sect, as did Archbishop Thuc and Archbishop Lefebvre. In the external form, many traditionalist movement clerics have never been members of the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church from the time they received tonsure, minor orders, and major orders. Some of them received tonsure and holy orders from bishops in the old Catholic Church. Others received holy orders from Archbishop Lefebvre and Archbishop Thuc while they were part of the non-Catholic Novus Ordo sect. Those men in the 1200s were all Catholic priests, consecrated for explicit, specific, and precise dioceses. They did not live as if they had universal jurisdiction, as do the many popes/bishops of the traditionalist movement. The men chosen to be bishops in the 1200s were already Catholic priests with jurisdiction and had been sent by the Catholic Church. Can you name one traditionalist movement bishop that did not leave the Catholic Church first before he was consecrated? Some left the Catholic Church and received their consecrations from the schismatic old Catholics. Those consecrated by Archbishop Lefebvre were all first part of his non-Catholic sect. Even the older priests coming through Archbishop Thuc, such as Bishops Vizalis, McKenna, and Vita Elmer, were first part of the Novus Ordo sect, or other non-Catholic sects. They were never received back into the Catholic Church by any bishop or priest that still had authority and jurisdiction. Therefore, they remained non-Catholics without jurisdiction when they were consecrated by another bishop who was also a non-Catholic at the time of the consecration. The laws about having a papal mandate were not nearly as specific and clear in the 1200s as they now and were at the time when Pope Pius XII died. The new bishops in the 1200s did not start up new religions. They still had unity among themselves and were in complete unity with the other Catholics throughout the world. In his article, Bishop Mark A. Peperonis, CMRI, also writes, quote, "Under these unprecedented circumstances, we must consider the position of true Catholic bishops. Faced with the great apostasy predicted by St. Paul in his second epistle to the Thessalonians, what were they to do? Were they to do nothing? The opponents of the consecration of bishops in our times would answer in the affirmative. Thus, at the death of those traditional Catholic bishops who remained faithful to the true faith, there would be no bishops left to succeed them, and without bishops, there would eventually be no priests no Mass, and no sacraments," unquote from Bishop Mark Peveronis. The true problem that faces us today is to find those traditional Catholic bishops who remained faithful to the true faith. What Bishop Peveronis failed to relate is the truth that Archbishop Thuc and Archbishop Lefebvre are not the Catholic bishops who remained faithful to the true faith. Let those who are known as the Traditionalist Movement clerics honestly, truthfully, and clearly explain how Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre and Archbishop Thuc remained faithful to the true faith. Please come forth with your spiritual help. How did these two archbishops remain faithful to the true faith while they were members of the non-Catholic Novus Ordo religion? Who among their spiritual offspring remained faithful to the true faith? Was it the SSPX bishop, Richard Williamson, who has a Freemasonic Rosicrucium red rose on his coat of arms? Please answer question 175. Do you think that this is a good way to display to the world exactly to what and to whom he and the Society of St. Pius X are truly connected? Did Bishops Clemente, Dominguez, Gomez, Manuel, Alonso, Corral, and Francis Bernard Sandler remain faithful? All of them are consecrated on January 11, 1976 by Archbishop Thuc. This website provides information. http://www.tboyle.net/catholicism/thuc_consecrations.html. Notice what happened in the case of Bishop Manfred Damasco Zewell. He was first ordained a priest by Clemente Dominguez Gomez. Just 15 days later, he was consecrated by the same Clemente Dominguez Gomez with Manuel Alonso Corral and Francis Bernard Sandler as assisting bishops. Just 6 months later, Zewell was conditionally consecrated by the same Manuel Alonso Corral with Francis Bernard Sandler as one of his assisting bishops. Should we ask why Clemente Dominguez Gomez's consecration was questioned? Why did Manuel Alonso Corral with Francis Bernard Sandler have to take the second attempt at making Zewell a bishop? Look at the case of Joseph Xavier Grager Burgoffer from among these bishops who do not need a papal mandate, according to Bishop Peveronis. Firstly, Clemente Dominguez Gomez ordains Joseph Xavier Grager Burgoffer. Secondly, Helmut Norbert Maas attempts to conditionally ordain Burgoffer. Thirdly, Clemente Dominguez Gomez consecrates Joseph Xavier Gregor Burgoffer. Fourthly, Helmut Norbert Maas again conditionally consecrates him. Should we ask why Joseph Xavier Gregor Burgoffer had Clemente Dominguez Gomez consecrate him? He had such great doubts about the validity of his ordination by Clemente Dominguez Gomez that he had Helmut Norbert Maas attempt to conditionally ordain him. Was Joseph Xavier Gregor Burgoffer at least being consistent when he decided that if Clemente Dominguez Gomez did not ordain him a priest, he probably did not make him a bishop either? He must have had such thoughts or doubts to that effect to have Helmut Norbert Maas attempt to conditionally consecrate him. All this took place in just 1 year and 2 days.